So let's explore this topic about finding happiness and the search for happiness. The subtitle, The Journey Home. The mind tends to create opposites. So in the search for happiness, we overlook that that's what the mind does. That's how it functions. If there's good, then there is bad. If there's pleasant, there's unpleasant. If there's a holy, there's a depraved. If there's the in crowd, there is the out crowd. If I'm happy, I'll also be unhappy. So, from the perspective of the mental structure, that's how it actually operates. We long for this happiness, not realizing unhappiness is the same coin. So if I take a coin like this, on one side is heads, one side is tails, and I turn that, oh, it's heads, I'm happy. I'll turn it again, oh, it's tails. We don't realize it's part of the same coin. The same mental structure creating opposites. And from that particular mental frame, one will never have lasting happiness. Let's explore that a little bit further. The more I hold on to pleasure, wanting pleasure as my, that's what I want, the more I push away from pain. The more I pursue goodness, the more I'm obsessed with evil. How often times do we see particular evangelists or people who are kind of spouting the good but have no tolerance for anyone that's slightly different to them in whatever shape that manifests? So basically, they've created good in their mind, and at the same time, they've created evil or people that are not worthy and need to be somehow changed. Do you know what I'm talking about? Can you see how that's easier to see when it's so obvious in front of us? The more I seek success, and success is my main driver to be successful in life and to be wealthy, the more I would dread failure. And failure would be the worst thing ever. You sometimes hear the extreme events of that when people who were doing quite well, suddenly life takes a turn and they can't live with themselves anymore. The more I try to live up to my self-image, the image that I've created of who I am, the more I have to keep the opposite down and covered up. Because I can't be that. If I think of myself as a nice person, I have to bury the parts of me that are perhaps not so nice sometimes. And that's how the mind plays a fickle game of siding with one side of the coin and wanting to avoid the other. The more I value anything very strongly and I get obsessed about it, I will also be obsessed by its loss. If you really value a particular piece of porcelain in your house or a cup because it's very precious to you, and when it breaks, you'll be distraught because suddenly one's been really obsessed with this cup, thinking it's going to last forever. So we suppose that life, and this is how the mental structure operates, we suppose that life would be perfectly enjoyable if we could only eradicate all the negative, unwanted things. And that's what the mind tries to consistently try to do. Keep going for the positive. So when something negative happens, what happens? What's our experience? We feel down, we get depressed, we get disappointed, and on it goes. So, of course, we want to feel well. Of course, we all want health and we all want to be happy. And yet, that's not how life works at the level of material form and in the world of also our mental projection onto it. So, is it possible to have a wave without a crest? Waves are like this. And it seems the world that we live in, the world of form, has all these ups and downs. There's night and day. It's all these things are so obvious to us. We don't realize how we project that into the world of our own happiness. And so, where do we go with that? Where do we find this happiness? In the Lakhanvatara Sutta, which is a Mahayana Buddhist text or discourse, they say the false imagination teaches that such things as light and shade, long and short, black and white are different and are to be discriminated. But they are not independent of each other. They are only different aspects of the same thing. These things are not independent of each other. They are connected. They are only different aspects of the same thing. They are terms of relation, not of reality. In essence, things are not two, but one. That is very hard to comprehend. What on earth is meant by that? Another comment is ultimate reality is a union of opposites. Reality is free from all boundaries. Again, difficult to understand. And how does that relate to the kind of happiness we seek? So let's explore a little bit further, shall we? One quote from A.H. Almas, the founder of the Diamond Approach work, in a book called The Pearl Beyond Price. It's a very big book, so I wouldn't write that down just yet, but unless you've got appetite for really serious books, extraordinary piece of work, though. He says this: one cannot seek happiness. One cannot seek happiness. For it is the result of realizing the truth. The personality which has security and pleasure as its aim cannot be happy. The personality which has security and pleasure as its aim cannot be happy. That is a bit of devastating news. And difficult to digest because most of us live in that world of the personality wanting to be happy. So we're really here still talking about where do we find happiness? What is the journey home? And which home are we talking about? So I'll read to you a quote, which is something even more bewildering. But it's usually not a quote we would do on the first night of a retreat because it's kind of out there. But yet it is a fundamental truth. We'll read it to you anyway. Nisargadatta Maharaj, which was an Indian sage in the Advaita Vedanta tradition, when he was asked, "Who are you?" he replied, "I am not a person in your sense of the word, though I may appear as a person to you." So I would appear as a person, but inside I'm not really a person in the normal sense of the word. I am that infinite ocean of consciousness in which all happens. I am that infinite ocean of consciousness in which all happens. I am also beyond all existence and cognition, pure bliss of being. There is nothing I feel separate from, hence I am all. Yet, no thing is me, so I am nothing. Life will escape, the body will die, but it will not affect me in the least. Beyond space and time, I am uncaused, uncausing, yet the very matrix of existence. So that is right out there. If you don't quite understand what it means, that's fine. A part of you might. So he's really referring here to that infinite ocean of consciousness as being what he has realized as who he is. Now, in Advaita Vedanta, this is the way their language and their realization appear. In Buddhist teachings, he wouldn't go that far. He would never say, I am this or I am that. He was very concerned in his teachings that we would identify with even these words and latch onto them. So he kind of often will talk about what we are not. But at the most, he would say, there is the unconditioned. There is the deathless. So he pointed to it in that way. He never said that he was that. So just giving you two traditions perspectives, but really they are talking of the same truth if we don't get attached to it. From Nisargadatta Maharaja's perspective, this is realizing our ultimate home, what Buddha called the deathless, that which does not die. Fascinating. So where are we in relation to all of this? And what is the journey home? Initially, we all live with this sense of there's this outer life and the inner life. We can say this initially because this is an artificial split between the outer and the inner. It's helpful to make right now. If we look at our outer life, by outer life, I mean the life of having to have a job, drive a car, having families, relationships, all the things we do in the world, all the projects we take on, all the things we get involved with. They seem to run on particular principles. So what do? If you want to learn to do something, we go out and get a book or do a course and you learn it. Yeah? And so the outer life is very much driven by having goals, having intention, working, developing knowledge, developing skills, making some effort, and trying hard. Has that been your experience? Does that resonate? Yeah, that's what we do in the world. That's the mechanism of it. And the mind, when we turn to the inner world, the mind understandably tries to navigate the inner life and trying to find happiness in the same way. So when our mind or personality tries to find happiness, it tries to apply the same principle. It tries harder, tries to do its best, tries to please other people, do what we think will give us happiness, and we hope that it does, especially in relationships. If we've been raised in relationships with the idea that if I am a good person, if I'm good to my brothers and sisters and to other people, that my parents will love me. And so that's the model we have for how we get love in the world. You have to try hard to be good and to do all the things that so that the other person will love you. Have any of you tried that approach? How's it going? It's exhausting. It works for a while until you find the perfect partner. Yeah, I like the fact that you're seeing the humor in that, because you've been there. Yeah? And the perfect partner means when you do all the things you think will give you love and they don't respond and then they give you that back, you don't know what the hell to do. All it feels devastating. and you say, I better find another one. So this is what I mean about we navigate the inner world with the same principles of the outer world. And we really, in many ways, have no choice, because that was what was imprinted in a very early age. Our way of getting love. So for some of us, the way of getting love is to be more of the rebel, more the naughty child. You get more attention for being that. And so you try to do that the rest of the time. And for others, it would be, I have to be really smart. I have to be clever. Whenever I do good at school, my mum and dad really praises me. Everybody looks up at me, I do really well. And so from then on, we strive to be really good at everything. And we have to be the smartest person in the room all the time. And you see what I mean about the happiness that we then seek from the level of personality has been very much imprinted from very early years at a time when you had no choice at all in the matter. And so the inner life works on different principles. And I think many of you are already aware of that, and we've already touched into it first day in the retreat. The inner life gets navigated by very different principles. There is effort in it, but it's a different kind of effort. The Buddha was asked, and this is in a particular sutta with a devata, which were meant to be like the celestial beings, were talking to the Buddha. There's some Buddhist mythology in there, which is quite lovely. And they asked the Buddha, how, dear sir, did you cross the flood? What they mean by the flood is our world over here is like the flood. How did you get to the other shore where there's, you know, happiness, bliss, and quiet? And Buddha replied, by not halting, friend, and by not straining, I crossed the flood. But how is it, dear sir, that by not halting and by not straining, you crossed the flood? And Buddha said, when I came to a standstill, then I sank. But when I struggled, I got swept away. It is in this way, friend, that by not halting and by not straining, I crossed the flood. We can apply this to our time here on retreat. If we halt and kind of give up because it's too hard, you would drown in whatever is sitting with you. It would stay in the level of personality. If we try too hard, and by struggling here is meant, try to push away that which is unpleasant. Does that make sense? To me, that's a struggle. You know, when you really got an emotion and it's not, you don't like it, you want to go away, and we struggle inside, that's the struggle. We're going to get swept away by what's going on. Not only is there a strong, difficult emotion or something arising, there's also the resistance to it, which is another level of struggle and pain. And so that's the application, in a way, of those teachings directly to our work here. How each day, each sit, each moment, this is a balancing point. It's not just a one-off. It's a balancing point each time. You sit in meditation. Am I just letting it run, vegging out, not even attempting to stay with mindfulness? That's kind of basically beginning to drown in what's going on. Or am I really pushing, trying really hard, trying to really get that breath to stay there where it's meant to stay and everything else? Now that's actually bringing too much tightness. And now there'll be efforting and getting swept away. Okay, so that's something each one of us has to do almost every sit, all the time. What's happening right now? Where's the balance right now for me? So a clue on how to navigate the inner journey is offered also by Buddha in the Anguttara Nikaya, the book in the Pali Canon. And he talks about, he says, the mental intoxicants. I'll let you work out what the mental intoxicants are for now, or they're called the kilesas, are overcome and abandoned not by virtue of speech or by virtue of action, but by seeing and understanding them. So the mental intoxicants is really when your brain's going round and round and round. That's mental intoxicants, especially if it's got judgments about you, judgments about your life, judge about everything else. They're mental intoxicants. They create difficulties. They create unhappiness. So here he is, such a long time ago, way long time ago, when people had, rich people had elephants and others had swords and everybody else had very little. He's able to see and perceive this truth of saying, how do we, in a way, overcome and abandon these difficulties? And he says, by seeing and understanding them. So the inner life, the journey home, is about seeing and understanding, not struggling to change. The more you want to change something that's internal in your mind, the more it will persist. Have you noticed that? Any emotion that is not felt and turned towards will persist. It wants to move. It wants to be seen. It will persist. So the inner journey home is less about doing, which is what our personality is good at doing, and is more about being. Less about doing, more about being. There's nothing wrong with doing. Doing in this world is the most enjoyable thing, especially if you're really present when you're doing it. It's even more enjoyable. But if we're doing things on automatic, that becomes just another treadmill. So doing itself can be a wonderful lived experience, a fully lived and rich experience in the world. And when it's coupled with being, it becomes life itself. So let's explore now. Things we're going to talk about now are very much exactly what you all already know. Everything I've said to you right now, you already know. What we're developing in meditation, and some of you have been doing this for years, is to realize that your life, there is a flow in your life. All of us, there's a life flow. We go and get up, do things. Your whole life has been directed in its own ways. And there is also that capacity in you that is perceiving that flow. And is actually untouched by it. I'll give you, some of you may be able to relate to this. Some of you are probably maybe too young. Let's explore. Have you ever caught yourself in the mirror and you realize, my God, I look old, much older than what I feel. Have you ever said that to yourself? I feel older than I feel. Who is speaking? Who's saying that? That which is witnessing your life, which we sometimes call consciousness, may have other names, but we don't even have to have a name because you know it. So awareness is already here. It doesn't seem to age as you age. That's what I'm talking about, because we've had the experience of seeing yourself in the mirror, but yet you feel younger. I remember actually a person, maybe I can talk about her now. I know some of you remember Bob Hawke, the Prime Minister in Australia. I had the good fortune to meet his wife, and we were having a conversation, and she was about to have a facelift. And she says, I don't recognize it myself in the mirror because I don't feel like that person. And so she thought a facelift would help, which she went about to do. So again, it shows a disparity between the body here and this other element that's going on for every one of us, this awareness that is present. Now, it's fascinating about awareness because, as you would have heard, it's already here. It is part of your being. Without us, you wouldn't actually be functional. So it's fascinating that we don't necessarily recognize it as strongly. or is so much in the foreground, it seems so much in the background. Let's do a very small exercise here for a moment. I would like you to take a moment and try to stop being aware. Just stop it, okay? Stop being aware. All this meditation stuff and everything else, just stop being aware for a moment or two. Don't be conscious of any sounds or sights, sensations, anything at all, thoughts. Just don't be conscious of anything. How'd you go? Did anyone succeed? So even while you're asleep, and if you remember your dreams, there was a consciousness present. It's only in the deepest sleep when you have a sleep without dreams. Well, deepest sleep, like you wake up in the morning, you don't know where the night's gone. One can say consciousness was had extinguished. It was like very much in the background. This can also happen in deep meditation. There can be cessation of consciousness while you're still sitting there. It just disappears. But really, that's the only way that I know that one can consciousness can actually kind of switch off. The rest of the time, your consciousness is alive, it's present. So it points and informs us that it's actually not a skill to learn. It's not something you have to develop. It's already there. Often we think that our minds is the one running the show, and it's the mind or thoughts that see everything. But if you look more carefully, you realize it's awareness that registers thoughts, not the other way around. Thoughts may have a word with it, like I'm talking to you now, I'm calling it awareness, and now there's a thought about it. But even as I'm saying that to you, there is an awareness that is noticing all this conversation. So we're now touching into where the road to happiness lies. The forest monk traditions in Thailand will call that aspect of our being the original mind. In the Tibetan Buddhism, there's a whole field of study called Rigpa. Francis of Assisi in the Christian tradition said, "What you're looking for is who is looking." He's not using the word awareness here or consciousness. What's he saying? What you're looking for is looking. Who's that who said, "I don't feel like that person"? That can't be me. In Zen, it's called the mind ground or mind essence. In the Hindu yogis, timeless witness is another name. You would have seen and heard many of those descriptions. You would have read, those of you who widely read, these words appear in many, many places. There are different qualities to this, you could say, awareness. In the Tibetan Book of the Great Liberation, it's called the true state. They say true state consciousness is naked, immaculate, clear, vacuous, transparent, timeless, beyond all conditions. The word timeless fits in, doesn't it? It seems that our body ages, but this consciousness doesn't seem to age. And they finish with the words, "O nobly born, remember the pure open sky of your true nature." So, what is the work we're doing here? How come we're all not sitting in this? This is all we've got. We all have this awareness. It's not a skill to learn. It's not something to develop. So what are we doing here? What's going on? And why does it feel so hard sometimes? So a word directly again from Buddha in the Anguttara Nikaya. It says, "Luminous is consciousness. Brightly shining is its nature. But it becomes clouded by the attachments that visit it." So, really, this consciousness because in many ways it's a mirror of whatever's going on, doesn't seem to have agency. You know what I mean by that word? Like our mind's got agency. I want to go to dinner, you get up and you go. That's agency. I want to change my clothes, agency. I want to drive somewhere. In other words, you're making decisions and moving. Consciousness doesn't seem to have that. For years, I was really perplexed by this. I thought to myself, if consciousness is so damn good, how come it's so easily covered up? You know, why is it that? And I kept looking for that. I almost cautious of using this quote, but I was raised in a Catholic religion, and I do remember these words. God created man in his image and gave him free will. Never understood that. In a way, awareness fits the bill. If I take the word God and some of the other connotations of the white person up there in the clouds and everything else that, you know, Christianity may easier to take those images up. If we take that away and you realize it's actually very accurate. We have been created from, in fact, it fits in with Nisargadatta Maharaj. We have been created from this consciousness. And we have free will. Your mind can do what it likes. And this mind of ours, given with its story and conditions, seems to cloud our true perception of consciousness. It clouds it so easily. And yet, as you've all experienced, there are many moments when it is unclouded. What's it like when you have a moment where you are much more in touch with your own beingness? You're present to a moment of experience or to yourself. You're not troubled by the past or the future. You're just present. What's that experience like? You call it out loudly? Effortless? Other descriptions. What's it like for you? Peaceful? Expansive? A relief? Calm? Could you speak loudly, please? Free of opinions. Yeah, it's free. And so what you've just described, you've touched into the very state that Nisargadatta Maharaj is talking about. The very state. His experience of that state is the same as yours. It is open, all the words you've just said, same. Peaceful, open, free, a relief. And if you look more closely, you'll see the mind is not busy, no judgment, no worries, no concern, no anxiety, no story. Almost nobody home from the personality's perspective. But there's something else present. What is present? Hard to describe. Because what is present, from the Buddhist tradition, he would say, it is not you. One could say it's a totality. It's where everything has arisen from. And when we touch into it, however momentarily, that's the experience we're having. It's a question of how quickly it gets covered up by the next thought, or when we don't recognize it. We don't recognize it. In Buddhist teaching, especially around mind states, he would say, notice when the mind is contracted, notice when the mind is expanded. He didn't say, just look at the bad stuff and suffering. In mindfulness of mind, which is the third foundation of mindfulness, he very clearly, all of the instructions are, notice the mind is expanded, notice the mind is contracted. Notice the mind is lustful, notice the mind is free of lust. Notice the mind is still, notice it's agitated. So it is just as important for us to recognize and acknowledge states of mind that are expansive, that are open, that are loving. It's important to actually hold that, to sense it, let it be a recognition of that. Why am I saying this to you? Because as you would have heard some of previous talks, that our mental capacity is wired very specifically to mostly focus on the negative. There are statistics for that. I don't quite believe them. They say 4 out of 5, but I think it's much higher. It's more like 9.5 out of 10. The mind is biologically geared to focus on the negative. So if you already have a leaning towards anxiety, your mind will love it because it's going to feel right at home with that. Okay, it's wired for that. You can see that from a survival perspective, it makes sense. It makes sense that when you've, I know, I don't quite remember it, but I know it still makes an imprint. The last time I may have run a red light or could have been orangey red and it felt really dangerous, what does my mind say? Other than the whole body getting pretty well freaked out, especially if there was somebody that nearly hit me, you know, like nearly an accident happened, what happens in the body? Right? The whole adrenaline rush. And what's the message you get? This is bad. Don't do it again. Okay, so you can see biologically it is important for that to be the default mechanism that is very fast to give you lessons. Touch something that's really hot, quickly you learn, don't touch that again. And then you may end up having fear of it, and now the fear magnifies and magnifies and magnifies. And so you see, wisdom is around noticing when the mind is actually now on automatically default unhappiness patterns. And so the importance of recognizing open, spacious, peaceful states when they arise. The importance to really say, wow, this is beautiful. This is also a way of being able to land into happiness. And notice the happiness we are speaking about now, was not a happiness due because you were eating a bar of chocolate or something good happened outside. It was an internal state. There still will be the happiness of some chocolate, if that's what you like, and other things. That also is a different happiness. We are not talking about the deeper happiness, the happiness that's not based on objects, the happiness that itself does not die, even though it takes a few more steps to really realize that fully. And that's okay. So we begin the journey in our meditation practice, and you can see now why perhaps you were drawn to this retreat, whether you any retreat we go to, all practices you've done in the past and possibly will do in the future. All is about trying to arrive or more and more remove the obstacles that are covering up your true nature. And it's even hard to say your true nature, because it's actually not yours either. It is just true nature. Of being embodied with a consciousness. And so we begin our journey, and as we see from our meditation retreat and our meditation practices, there is an active component in meditation, and also there's a passive side to it. The active component is what we're doing when we give you a practice in the morning and encourage you to practice or do the practice you already have. You need to realize that that is a meditation practice. It's there for a purpose. What is the purpose of meditation practice, especially the mindfulness practices, whether we're focusing on parts of the breath or the whole breath, whether it's Satipatthana, Anapanasati, or others? What is the purpose? What are we trying to do there? In one or two words, what would you say? Sorry? We're settling the mind and body. That's a great way to see it. Yeah, it's more than good enough. Left to its own devices, the mind and body will remain agitated. We're bringing attention of the mind. We are using intention. We are using focusing. And we are using the body to come back to a part in the body. Today was the whole breath, the whole body breathing. Now, in that moment, we are purposely not getting caught in the other aspects that are running. And if you're doing well, you might be able to focus on the body breathing three times. You'd be doing quite well, especially if you had an active entry point for the retreat, active life before the retreat. Now, that in a way is not the end state. That is purely a mental practice. You know, a bit when you've got a new puppy, you get a new puppy in your house and you're trying to tell it to only stay in this room and not go scratching every other room, right? And you're training the puppy to stay here for now. There'll come a time when the puppy will be allowed to go everywhere. But right now, we can't, the puppy is not quite trained yet. It's too little, it doesn't know. And we've got to keep it there and scratch the things we don't mind it scratching for a little while until we can let it loose. So that's what we're doing really with the practices. We're beginning to turn the mind towards an object of meditation, allowing the mental faculties to begin to settle, perhaps to ease a little bit. And that's the first stage. Initially, constantly. And then as you stay with the body, the Anapanasati in particular will begin to develop particular qualities that are available. And now we can notice what's possible when we do that. Now we've gone past the puppy analogy. Now we've gone into there's something else arising when we can experience presence itself. Presence itself has a quality. We'll be talking about that tomorrow morning. And so that's what we do with our meditation initially, with the intention and a little bit of effort, the right effort needed to just keep settling our body and mind. And then there comes a time where inquiry is important. So things arise, and it may be they could arise in the way of thoughts. And now we don't want to push everything away, or thoughts or emotions. And when they arise, we turn our attention towards them in the way we best know how. There are different methods. Some of you would have learned different ways of doing that. But we, rather than push away what are really the obstacles, we allow them in. And they mostly will appear as beliefs, thoughts, and emotions. And other work we're doing on this retreat in particular, which is more, it's a different inquiry, it's allowing the body in the somatic practices to shake, whether subtle or gross. That's a form of inquiry and what arises from just being present to that process and noticing what arises. Sometimes it's just energy moving, sometimes some information is revealed to you. And then there's other inquiries we can do. And the inquiries now are much more to do with the Dharma. And on the fourth day, we'll be exploring that in our guided meditations. So I won't say too much about that, which is basically recognizing the nature of this worldly form that we are in and not pretending. This worldly form is born, it will age, it will have sickness and death, and all the bits in between. Things will change, the law of anicca. And the identity we hold, the identity views we have about ourselves. There'll be some Dharma talks also through this week about that topic. So we'll cover that through the week. All of these, when seeing clearly and getting some insight, remove what covers up this clear mind, this state of being feeling awake, the state of peace, the state of spaciousness, and the states of love. All of these teachings are pointing to different things that kind of cover us up. And that gives you the sense of the journey in a way. Then there are some passive practices of meditation and just being, is when you're just sitting outside and just sitting, or sitting in the hall and just sitting. You're not meditating, you're not meditating. You're open to all senses, including thoughts, and you let whatever comes and goes come and go, and consciousness is present to all of it. Now, that takes a little bit more settling for that to be a steady state, That can happen later on retreats, and many of you in the room are aware of that style of meditation called choiceless awareness. But that is a very powerful segue movement from the meditations which we are more active to the meditations which are more passive. In other words, totally surrendering to awareness being the dominant field. And depending where you are on this retreat and when that'll be available to you. So there you go, folks. We start to see that there is happiness in this world. And the happiness in this world will always be up and down because it does rely on opposites. You have a good meal, you have a not so good meal. They relate to each other. How would you know it was good if you didn't have a bad one? How do you know that particular experience was fantastic compared to the one that was really boring? They match each other. You wouldn't know one without the other. The happiness we're talking about here, which is the happiness of being more present, being more in consciousness, where that is usually in the background, becomes much more in the foreground. And then they become an intermingling, living life, both being present, being very present to your life, doing everything you've already been doing. And yet somehow its quality changes because something in you has changed. Something in you is now more fulfilled. And the biggest shift that occurs is that you are no longer looking for fulfillment in the external. It's not as if you have a deep deficiency and somehow you will only feel good if you have that. The fulfillment occurs from the connection to true nature, the connection of this awareness. And the beautiful part of it, you can live fully in the world, enjoying all the things you used to do. Mind you, there needs to be a cigarette warning, a bit like the back of the packet. A lot of the things, the back of a cigarette packet said, don't have this, it's going to cause you difficulties. Well, the difficulties this journey can cause you is some of the things you seeked before and wanted to have may no longer look satisfying. Buddha talked about that extensively. You become dispassionate about certain things. And that can sometimes feel like a bit of a loss. But on the other hand, the reason they become dispassionate is because you see that they will not give you what you truly seek. And when you see into that, they lose their luster. And so we come back to what really truly feels satisfying within, which is this sense of presence and awareness. And every time you touch into that, it reinforces that sense in you. And everything else begins to diminish compared to that. So that is the journey home. And whether you know it or not, that's a journey you've all been on. You will not be here otherwise. For whatever reason brought you, it's going in that direction. Let's take a moment to stop there. Let's reflect on what lands for you from what you've heard tonight. Thank you for your presence. Thank you for listening.